hanging from their eaves. He drove past her house, then rounded the block and parked in front of a vacant house that was for sale. In a casual, strolling pace, he walked around the corner, halfway along her block, then straight up the brick walkway to her front door. He didn't look around to see if any of her neighbors were observing him. In under 30 seconds, he'd picked the lock with tools and skills he'd been taught in prison. It was like performing a magic trick, and he'd always been fascinated by sleight of hand. He let himself in and fully expected a home alarm to go off, but nothing happened. So, unless it was a silent alarm, which was a possibility, his intrusion had gone undetected. Nevertheless, he gave himself only 10 minutes to explore. That was the average time for alarm monitors to respond and dispatch the police. Prison was more educational than Harvard or Princeton. During the allotted 10 minutes, he wanted to learn as much as he could about the state prosecutor, who was operating under the delusion that she would keep him locked behind bars for the rest of his natural life. "Guess again," he whispered as he paused in the small foyer to slip off his shoes. The glow of a street light coming through the windows provided enough illumination for him to see his way around. In stocking feet, he entered the living room. It was furnished in a style more contemporary than the exterior of the house would indicate. He'd expected chintz and bric-a-brac, but from what he could tell in the semi-darkness, the tones were neutral, the decor tasteful and understated. Theo would approve. She had an expansive bookcase, the shelves loaded with reading material that ranged from dull-looking literary novels to steamy romances. Even wondered which she read most often. He moved from that room into the kitchen and was a bit surprised by it as well. She had state-of-the-art appliances, but none of the clutter characteristic of an industrious cook. The sink was empty, a dish towel folded over the edge of it. A ceramic bowl of blooming orchids occupied the center of the island. He pinched off one of the white blooms, sniffed it, then put it in his pocket. "You're very neat, Catherine, but not a chef." He backtracked and passed through the living room again, then followed his nose down a hallway, past a guest room, past a home office, to the hall's dead end at a bedroom that had to be hers. Like all the other rooms, it was tidy, but it had a more lived-in feel. There was a king bed, plus a chaise lounge. Both had an abundance of decorative pillows. A throw had been left draping the foot of the bed. He ran his hand over its luxuriant pile. Sleek surfaces in the kitchen, plushness in the bedroom. This was where she curled up to read the naughty fiction. When he opened the closet door, the light automatically came on. Since the blinds were drawn, he felt it was safe to leave it on. The walk-in was well organized. Three open shelves were devoted to high-heeled shoes. Stilettos, mostly. No thick ankles on Catherine, then. He glanced at his watch. He had a little over 2 minutes before he had to clear out. He went to the built-in chest of drawers. Being careful to cover his hand with his sleeve to avoid leaving fingerprints, he opened the top drawer. Underwear. Not the underwear of a woman with saggy tits and an unsightly wart. The bras were lacy and sheer. Not of a size that would ordinarily attract him, but he became aroused while rubbing his index finger over the moderate cup of one where a nipple would fit. Her panties also elicited a delightful stirring behind his fly. Some were thongs, some more practical, but none were maidenlike. He took a black lace thong and tucked it into his pocket along with the orchid blossom. He looked at his watch. 90 seconds left. Time to go. He didn't want to. He wanted to get to know Catherine Lennon better. Much better. He closed the closet door. The light went out. As he was about to slip from the room, he noticed a framed photograph on a side table next to the chaise. There were three people in the picture, but he couldn't see them clearly, so he risked turning on his phone's flashlight. The picture had been taken on a beach. The trio stood with their arms around one another's waists. Sandy feet, swimwear, all smiles. A man and a woman, who looked to be about his dad's age, were standing on either side of a woman with short platinum hair. She was wearing a bikini that matched the size of the undies in the chest of drawers. Her wide smile and the sun's glare had caused her gamin face to scrunch. But she looked cheeky and adorable. He cooed, "Hello, Catherine." Zack had felt like shit all day. By the time he'd come full circle of the trail at the B&B, Kate's SUV was no longer parked in front of the cottage, which was what he'd expected, and it was just as well. A second goodbye would have been more difficult than the first, but it didn't improve his mood to know that she had left. He'd gotten home in time to check the stock market before it closed. He'd been pleased to see that it had taken a bump in the right direction today. He'd spent an hour analyzing the data and had shot emails to those he knew would be interested. But he'd been restless and unable to concentrate. He whiled away most of the afternoon gazing out the window. The pending decision he must make about Rebecca's life had been as haunting as a ghostly cold breath on the back of his neck, and as burdensome as leg irons. He had told Kate he wouldn't be rushed, but in addition to his struggle with the moral and emotional ambiguities, time was a factor. If Eben took off to some place that was soft on extradition, keeping the miscreant permanently out of reach, would he ever forgive himself? He didn't think so. But the alternative was unthinkable. The sun had gone down. Dinner time had rolled around. He hadn't found anything in his kitchen that appealed to him, so he decided to drive into town for barbecue. The place was a block off the square, and he was known there. He'd ordered his regular combo plate and took it to a picnic table on the outdoor deck that overlooked a rippling creek. Heaters had been turned on to ward off the chill, but no one else had come outside, and he'd welcomed the solitude. As soon as he'd finished his meal, he headed for home, his frame of mind still in the dumps. Now, he was almost to his turnoff when a car shot out from a side road directly in front of his pickup. His tires skidded over the damp pavement as he stomped the brake pedal and swerved to avoid T-boning the other vehicle and the damn fool who was driving it. His truck shuddered to a stop, his back tires coming a mere foot short of the cliff. Caught by his seatbelt, he had to wait until it released, then engaged the emergency brake, flung open the door, and jumped out, angry and anxious at the same time. "Are you all right?" he called as he approached the sedan. Dave Morris squeezed himself out of the driver's seat. He wasn't in uniform. "Far from all right, you son of a bitch." He came lumbering towards Zack, who took a stance and squared off. "You were waiting on me to come along. How'd you know I'd be on the road? Saw your truck parked at the barbecue joint. Knew you'd be driving home sooner or later. So you laid an ambush. Where's your badge?" "Temporarily suspended, on account of you. After you talked to Mackie Parks, he called Sheriff Meeks and lodged a complaint against me." "Ah, gee, that's too bad." Baring his teeth, Morris lunged and took a swing at him, but Zack saw it coming and dodged the deputy's meaty fist. He landed what he thought would be a good blow to Morris's belly, but it was like he'd hit a sack of cement. Morris definitely had the advantage of weight, muscle bulk, and a lower center of gravity. But Zack was more agile. He scrambled backward, and when Morris came charging, Zack sidestepped at the last possible second. Rather than slamming into Zack, Morris rammed into the grill of Zack's truck with such impetus, he bounced back from it and dropped to his knees. Zack planted his large hand over the back of Morris's head and shoved his face into the unyielding metal. Morris cried out and slumped forward. That's when Zack saw the holster clipped to his belt at the small of his back. He wrangled the pistol from it and used his famous throwing arm to rocket the handgun into the dense woods bordering the road. Before Morris could regain his senses and balance, Zack wrapped his arm around his thick, tattooed neck and pulled his head back until they were glaring at each other upside down. You knew I wasn't involved in that vandalism over at Green Ridge. You only used that as an excuse to hassle me. I want to know why. Fuck you. Zach pulled Morris's head farther back and dug a knee into his kidney. Aren't you a little old to be playing back-at-you pranks? Keying my truck? What the hell, man? What's your problem with me? Kate Lennon? Morris ground out. Let me go. Not a chance. Piss on you, Bridger. Why are you harassing me? You're jealous because of Kate, right? Jealous of you? Of you? Fuck no. Zach pulled back his knee and then drilled it into soft tissue. Having had his share of kidney jabs on the playing field, he knew they hurt like bloody hell. Morris yelped, then whimpered, then gasped. Okay, yes. You're jealous of me and Kate? No. Which is it, Morris? Let me go. I'll tell you. He'd given in sooner and more easily than Zach would have expected. Fearing his surrender might be a ruse, he relaxed his hold on Morris gradually, then backed away. The deputy used handholds on the grill to pull himself upright. Once on his feet, he turned around unsteadily and propped himself at a slant against the hood, favoring the side Zach had jabbed. His lip was split. His nose and eyes were already becoming swollen and discolored. Zach felt no sympathy whatsoever for wreaking the damage. If he hadn't stopped his pickup in time, it would have gone over the cliff, taking him with it. Without his having had years of experience out-finessing rampaging linebackers, this asshole would have pounded him to a pulp or shot him. So, no tender-heartedness for Dave Morris. Talk to me, Zach demanded. Where's my pistol? 30 or 40 yards that way, Zach said, tipping his head. Search to your heart's content. What's behind the harassment? Morris raised his hand to his lip and blotted its slobbery blood. I was asked to keep an eye on you. Zach hadn't expected that. Keep an eye on me? Spy, you mean? Morris raised a shoulder in admission. What for? That's for you to find out, cocksucker, he sneered. You may have cost me my job. No, that'll be your fault, Morris, not mine. I didn't cook up false allegations just so I could go window peeping into your house. Who asked you to keep an eye on me? You're such a hot shot. You figure it out. With an effort, Morris pushed away from the support and started stumbling away. But Zach grabbed him by the arm and slung him back against the hood of the pickup. Who's behind this? Morris glared with belligerence and remained stubbornly silent. Did you take money to spy on me? Morris added malice to his glare. So you did. Corruption is a lot more serious than keying my truck, Zach said. You tell me now who retained your services, or you'll tell me in front of the sheriff. I'm sure he'll be interested to hear that you took a bribe. His jaw working, Morris molded over. Okay, he said, I'll tell you. But you gotta clear me with my boss. Wrong. I don't gotta do shit. Then you'll die wondering. Zach began to chuckle. No, I won't. I don't need you to tell me. I already know who it was. Through his fattening nose, the deputy snorted with scorn. I'm not falling for that old bluff. Zach said, Eben Clark. Kate didn't remember ever being as weary as she was when she arrived home. It was almost 11 o'clock. After the drive back to Atlanta, she'd gone to her office as planned. What was intended to be a brief stop had turned into a 7-hour stint. She'd spent that time with her assistant replying to backed-up correspondence and being brought up to speed on other cases she was working on in one capacity or another. Uppermost in her mind, however, was Eben Clark. Before leaving for home, she'd emailed the AG, writing, I've had several meetings with Zach Bridger. After some initial reluctance, he became more open to discussing the situation with Eben Clark, and now understands that our moving forward hinges on his decision regarding Rebecca Pratt. He requested time to think on it. In the meantime, I suggest the surveillance on Clark be continued indefinitely. He has the means, cunning, and backing of his influential father to pull up stakes and flee at any time. It was a coin toss as to whether or not the boss would approve that request. Even Clark was a free man. At this point, there was no probable cause to justify keeping him under surveillance. He was living like a prince, but doing nothing illegal. She entered her house from the garage door that opened into the kitchen. She flipped on the light, went over to the island, and with relief, let her heavy bag slide off her shoulder onto the countertop. Noticing that several sprigs of Spanish moss had shaken loose from the container of orchids, she swept them into her hand and patted them back into place. In the fridge was a bottle of Chardonnay already opened. She poured herself a glass, smiling ruefully and saying softly, "Sometimes I drink white." She slipped her phone from the outside pocket of her bag. Taking it and the wine with her, she turned off the kitchen light and made her way through the living room, using only the ambient light coming through the front windows. But as she moved into the hallway that led to her bedroom, for some inexplicable reason, she paused and looked back into the living room. Everything was as she'd left it. Nothing was amiss. But something compelled her to go into the foyer and make certain the front door was locked. It was. She'd never been a fraidy cat and couldn't account for the odd feeling, almost a shiver, that had come over her. But she attributed it to fatigue and continued down the hall. In the bedroom, she flipped the switch that turned on the bedside lamps. Setting her wine glass and phone on the table next to the chaise, she started toward her closet. Chapter 19. Just as Kate reached for the door handle, her phone rang. Thinking, hoping it might be Zach. She hurried back to the table. In her haste to grab the phone, she knocked over the picture of her with her parents on the beach. The gold frame clattered loudly against the glass tabletop. She righted the frame, then, after four rings, and without checking the caller ID, she answered rather breathlessly, "Hello? Ms. Lennon?" "Not Zach." She squashed her adolescent disappointment. "This is she." The man at the other end gave her his name and told her he was with the company that monitored her alarm system. "What's your password, please?" She hesitated, then gave him an erroneous one. "I'm sorry, that's not the password on record." "I'm glad you know that. I was testing you." After giving him the correct password, he said, "Your silent alarm was triggered this evening at 9:18. When you didn't answer our call, we left you a voicemail and dispatched the police." Her phone had rung while she was plowing through the work piled up on her desk. Not recognizing the number and believing it to be a spam call, she'd let it go unanswered and had ignored the voicemail notification. "Two patrolmen checked your house and yard," he was saying. "They reported there was no sign of a break-in. Your alarm was disengaged a few minutes ago, then immediately reset." "That was me. I just came in." "When we got the all clear from the police, we reset your alarm from here. Sometimes a low battery can set it off. I'm just following up to make sure everything is okay." Maybe animal instinct had caused the uneasiness that had crept over her minutes earlier. She darted a glance toward the closet door, the foot of the bed, the bathroom door standing ajar, the open bedroom door, and the dark hallway beyond. "Can you please hold on while I check the house?" "Yes, of course." She kept her phone in her hand as she looked first into the bathroom. No one there, nothing displaced. She knelt to check beneath the bed, then crossed to the closet. Heart in her throat, she twisted the horizontal handle on the door and yanked it open. The light flashed on. Nothing. Turning quickly, she moved to the door and looked down the hallway. Empty. Starting down it, she came first to her home office, where she turned on the light and checked the closet. She did the same in the guest room and bath. Unlike her own glass shower door, this one had a curtain, which she fearfully flung aside, then felt silly for being fearful. There was no place for an intruder to be hiding in the living room, If anyone had been lying in wait in the garage, she would have been attacked when she got out of her car. That left only the kitchen. She thought of the disturbed Spanish moss. Trying to keep the fear from her voice, she said, "Are you still there?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Thank you." With one switch, she turned on every light in the kitchen and blinked against the sudden glare. The only place for concealment was the walk-in pantry. She gathered her courage and opened the door. Nothing. She slumped against the door jamb, realizing only then how shaky her knees were. Inside her clothes, her skin had turned clammy. "Everything appears to be in order."
"You're all right?"
"Yes."
"Your duress code word, please?"
Her brain scrambled to come up with it, but she did.
"All right, Ms. Lennon. Have a good night."
"Thank you." She was hesitant to disconnect, but there was nowhere for someone to be hiding that she hadn't checked. Just as she clicked off to end the call, her doorbell pealed. The first words out of Zach's mouth were,
"What's the matter?"
"Nothing."
"Liar. Your face is as white as your hair. What's the matter?"
"How did you know where I live? Did you follow me here?"
"No, I left hours after you did. Made record time and came straight here."
"What's so urgent?"
"Something's come to light."
"You couldn't tell me over the phone?"
"Not this."
"Why?"
He could tell by looking at her that, despite her protests, she wasn't all that opposed to his being here. Something of consequence had happened to both of them during the intervening hours since he'd kissed her on the cheek and told her goodbye.
"Let's swap stories."
Looking wan and uncharacteristically skittish, she stood aside. He heard locks being clicked behind him as he left her at the front door and went into a living area where every light source was on full. As she entered behind him, she cut the overhead light. He turned to her.
"What's up?"
"You first."
"Nope, you're shook. Now for the third time, what's the matter?"
She hitched up her chin in defiance, but he stared her down and she wilted into an easy chair. He shrugged out of his jacket and sat down on the sofa facing her, elbows on his knees, leaning forward. With frequent starts and stops, she told him about the disturbing telephone call from the monitoring service. He listened with a growing sense of dread and apprehension. She finished with,
"I just hung up when you rang the doorbell. I nearly came out of my skin."
He stood up.
"Where are you going?"
"To take a look around."
"I told you, I searched."
He pointed his finger at her.
"Stay put."
Her house wasn't that large, and he easily found his way through it. He looked into every room and every closet, including a large storage area in the garage. After satisfying himself that they were the only two people there, he returned to the living area. Her boots were lying on the floor in front of the chair where she was curled up, a throw covering her legs and feet. She was hugging a decorative pillow against her chest like a teddy bear. He passed her the glass of wine he'd found on a table in the bedroom.
"Thank you," she said. "Can I offer you anything?"
He declined and resumed his spot on the sofa.
"Do you think it was a break-in?"
"I haven't had time to conduct an inventory, but the only thing that seems to have been disturbed is the moss in the planter on the kitchen island, and that could have happened when the furnace kicked on."
"Do you think a faulty battery set off the alarm?"
"It happens."
He just looked at her. She took a sip of wine.
"When I came in, I had this creepy sensation."
"Like someone had been in your house while you were gone."
She took another sip of wine.
"I don't know."
"I think you do, Kate. I trust your instincts, even if you don't."
He leaned against the back cushion of the sofa and stacked his hands on the top of his head.
"My turn?"
After she nodded for him to go ahead, he told her about his run-in with Dave Morris. The more descriptive he got, the wider her eyes grew.
"You didn't file the complaint on him," she exclaimed. "The Greenridge man did." "But whipping his ass wouldn't have given Morris bragging rights. Whipping mine would have."
"He could have killed you."
"He was no pushover. I was lucky to come away intact. But he's a bully, not a killer."
"As for his moonlighting," she said,
Do you really believe Eben Clark hired him to spy on you?
I tossed out his name as a bluff. Morris said he wouldn't fall for it.
He lowered his hands from his head and leaned into the space separating them.
But he did, he said with satisfaction. Like a ton of bricks. When I mentioned Eben Clark, he looked at me like I was too stupid to live. He said, the rich guy, your ex's party boy, he's in prison. And then to prove to me that I was the dumbest dumbass ever, Morris gave up the name. It was Doug Pratt.
With the statement reverberating between them, he sat back and said,
my barbecue supper is worn off.
She admitted that she'd had nothing since a quick salad lunch on her drive back to Atlanta. For the time being, they tabled their discussion and relocated to the kitchen. They built ham and cheese sandwiches to their individual preferences. She suggested they eat at the dining nook, built into a corner.
Dibs on the side with the couch, Zach said as he carried his plate over to the rectangular table.
Banquette.
Pardon?
That's what it's called.
Huh.
He slid in, settled into the corner, and stretched his legs along the length of the padded bench.
A bed in the kitchen. What a great idea.
He crunched a potato chip, and his mischievous poster boy grin just might have been the sexiest thing she'd ever seen. They made small talk between noshes. She said,
when you were telling me about your day leading up to your encounter with Morris, you mentioned checking the stock market. That's twice you've referred to it. Is it a pastime, hobby, or something more?
He pushed aside his empty plate, wiped his mouth with the paper napkin, sat up straight, and drew his legs beneath the table.
How good are you at keeping a secret?
I'm an attorney.
Oh, right. Well, one of the few smart things I did while playing in the NFL was not to blow my salary on cars, boats, condos in Cabo and Aspen, like that. My folks were the salt of the earth kind with a strong work ethic. I guess it rubbed off. Don't get me wrong, I lived well, but I didn't go nuts with the money I was making.
He gave a wry smile.
My most expensive extravagance was Rebecca.
Speaking her name momentarily clouded the natural glint in his eyes.
Anyway, I had sense enough to invest while I had the means, and I seemed to have a good eye for spotting opportunities.
Just how good an eye? The glint returned.
I've done okay. I was able to buy my property and build the house without dipping into my savings.
She raised her eyebrows. I'd say you've done better than okay. Is that the secret? People think you're washed up and destitute while in reality you're a reclusive millionaire?
That's part of the secret.
Are you willing to share the other part?
I have clients, he whispered. Yeah,
he said when he saw her surprise.
Once I was off the grid, I started watching young jocks who'd soared to stardom in their sport but were on the path to self-destruction. I honed in on one in particular. He had all the God-given talent an athlete could dream of, but he was going hog wild with his excesses. He was about to flame out. I contacted him. At first, he was flattered that he was talking to Zach Bridger, but when I started advising that he give moderation a try, he got defensive and cocky. You're just jealous because I'm here and you're not. Fine, I said, and told him not to call me on his way down, which was coming soon, if he didn't get his shit together and his head on straight. I hung up. 2 days later, he called me. I guess he figured that my advice, coming from one who'd sunk as low as one can go, was worth taking. While dishing out words to live by, I also gave him some tips on money management. He was clueless, didn't know his ass from an asset. I suggested he give me a trial run, turn over an amount for me to play with. If I lost it, or reduced it, I would guarantee a full refund out of my own pocket.
She laughed. Let me guess.
He was my first client, and he's still with me. Last Christmas, he sent me a set of golf clubs and a golf cart.
You're kidding.
No. I kept the clubs, but donated the cart to a college with a golf program.
That's a great story. Too bad I'm sworn to secrecy. Is there more?
I got my brokerage license,
The hobby evolved into a business. I can work out of my mountain house. Be a recluse. For me, privacy is the most valuable commodity. I've got a great setup, and I'm grateful.
Obviously, so are your clients. You probably have to turn down many.
He leaned forward and whispered, I handpick them. They don't pick me. And each has to sign a non-disclosure agreement not to tell who handles their investments. That's the deal I make with them. That's the secret. And now, I guess I'll have to kill you.
She wanted to lean across the table and kiss him. She wanted to badly, but the specter of Rebecca loomed large. She pushed back her chair and cleared the table. He slid off the banquette and asked if he could make a cup of coffee. She showed him where everything was. She steeped a cup of tea for herself, and when they were resettled back in the living room, she said, How did Doug Pratt contact Morris?
I asked. Apparently, Doug subscribes to the bi-weekly county newspaper online.
His way of keeping tabs on you.
I guess he wanted to see if my name ever cropped up in the local news. It did. I'd signed a petition against Green Ridge's development. When stories about the vandalism started appearing and mentioned Deputy Morris as one of the investigators, Doug contacted him. Actually, according to Morris, Doug laid it on thick. How I was dead set against anyone encroaching on what I perceived to be my mountain. How I was a tree hugger, anti-this, pro-that. Morris bought it. He admitted that when he first came snooping, he actually considered me a suspect. But then you showed up at my place, after hours, and that gave him a reason to dislike me.
He grinned.
His face is kind of messed up. I hope I didn't ruin the good thing you two have going.
Please, she moaned. They smiled across at each other. She wished the light-hearted, flirty banter could continue, but knew it couldn't. You believe someone was in my house, don't you?
Don't you?
I'm reluctant to, she said softly, but yes. Who?
I'm afraid that if I speculate, I'll be right.
Even Clark.
He made a motion with his shoulder. Or he sent someone.
She crossed her arms over her chest and rubbed her upper arms.
It makes my skin crawl. Mine too.
But I don't see how it could have been him, the investigator.
I'm sure your guy is good, but Eben is sly. He'd have figured out a way to give him the slip.
She shook her head. I checked with him late this evening before I left the office. He said Eben returned from a racquetball workout at 4 o'clock and hadn't left the house since.
Zach raised his hands in a gesture of helplessness. As I said, maybe he sent a toady, but how would he have gotten your name? It hasn't been publicized that you or anyone is considering another charge against him.
It hasn't been publicized, no. But his father, Sid, has a lawyer on retainer. They've been cheek to jowl for ages. Upton Franklin is his name. He's shrewd and he's corrupt. He's probably got a dozen or more snitches in the AG's office. Any red flag that appears next to a Clark's name, he hears of it within minutes. If it's nothing but a scratch, he starts immediately stanching the bleed.
Zach took a look around the kitchen before coming back to her. I don't think it's safe for you to stay here.
I'm not afraid.
First of all, you're lying. Secondly, I'm scared shitless.
What do you suggest I do?
Go to New Orleans with me tomorrow. Chapter 20.
Kate didn't say anything immediately. Then, for what purpose?
To see Doug.
Again, for what purpose?
You told me you had notified him of Clark's release.
He reacted with anger, disgust, all the justifiable emotions. He asked if I had notified you. At that point, I hadn't.
But now you have, and Morris has told Doug that you've been to see me. I'm certain that unhinged him. I need to talk to him, Kate, face to face. When I do, I'd like for you to be there.
To serve as a buffer?
More than that. You represent the Attorney General. That makes the discussion official, not personal. Otherwise, Doug will just bang heads with me. It also may influence his thinking if you impress on him what a threat even Clark is.
A flight risk, yes, but a threat?
I doubt he changed his spots or came to Jesus while in prison. If he remains free, other women could fall victim.
She looked at him thoughtfully. Last night, you referred to Rebecca as having been victimized by Eben Clark. Not everyone shares that opinion.
Don't you?
Well, Parsons and Simpson testified that she went into that room with them of her own volition. She knew what they were going in there for, and she participated. Enthusiastically, to quote Cal Parsons.
In all probability, that much is true, Zach said. But Rebecca loved life. Loved living. If at any point she'd felt that her life was in danger, she would have called a halt. In fact, I believe she would have fought like hell.
All three men had scratch marks on their arms and faces, Kate said. Their tissue was found under her fingernails. Clark's defense attorney couldn't refute the DNA evidence, but he reminded the jury of the sex toys found in that room. He said that scratching was part of their rough sex play. He raised a reasonable doubt.
That's what the Clarks paid him to do. Hell, you could create reasonable doubt about damn near anything. The sky is blue. No, it's gray. Actually, it can be either. Reasonably speaking, it's blue, but...
All right, you've made your point.
This is my point, and I'd stake my own life on it. Either Rebecca was incapable of saying the safe word, or she said it, and they ignored it. But even if she didn't fight, or couldn't, at any time past signaling no enough, she became a victim.
Kate had been listening, her expression intent. Her body tense, now her shoulders visibly relaxed.
I believe so, too. Then why'd you put up an argument?
Because that's what I'm paid to do, by the state.
Clever. You wound me up.
I needed to hear just how passionately you felt about it.
Now that you know, what about New Orleans?
When she hesitated, he said,
I took the liberty of booking a departure flight tomorrow morning for you and me.
Returning when?
That depends on Doug and the outcome of the meeting. I may be coming back by tomorrow evening, or I may be required to stay for several days. You could return directly after meeting with him. In all honesty, Kate, I can't predict what he'll say or do, but I believe it would be helpful to have you there. Will you come with me?
She thought on it, then said,
You put up a good argument yourself. Mr. Pratt and I met while preparing for Clark's release hearing. If he still considers me an advocate, that could be beneficial.
Yes, I'll go.
Can you clear it with the AG?
I'll send him an email tonight so he'll see it first thing in the morning. I'll phrase it to sound like a breakthrough I need to seize on, which it is. Zach stood up, reached for his jacket, and folded it over his arm.
I reserved a room for myself at one of the airport hotels. But that was before I knew you'd had an uninvited visitor tonight. So here are your choices.
Who are you to give me choices?
Ignoring that, he said, I wait while you pack and you come with me to the hotel.
Or?
I sleep here.
She looked aside, considering the options. What time is the flight?
8:30.
Early, then.
Early-ish, but we'd already be at the airport.
Again, she thought on it, then said, I'm truly exhausted. To pack, drive out there tonight sounds awful. Let's sleep here.
Then meeting his gaze, she added, The guest room is ready for occupancy. Damn,
he said it under his breath and with emphasis, but also humor. She snuffled a laugh. He went to stand near her, but didn't touch her. If he put his hands on her, he knew it would lead to kissing her. And if he kissed her, he'd start pawing her and tearing at her clothes. So he kept his hands and his longing in check.
Go send your email. I'll get my bag out of my truck and lock up.
All right. If you get up before I do, you know where the coffee makings are. Help yourself.
Thanks.
Good night. She turned and disappeared down the hallway. He went to the front door. Undid all the locks she'd secured, then went to his pickup and got his duffel bag out of the front seat. After checking all the door locks one last time, he retreated to the guest room. Like the rest of her house,
It was unfussy, unfrilly, and, thank God, had a king bed. He set an alarm on his watch and undressed. As he pulled back the covers and stretched out, he realized that parts of him were sore from his skirmish with Morris. He'd probably feel it more tomorrow. Through the wall, he could hear a shower running.
Don't think about it.
But of course he thought about it. Kate, naked. He'd already spent hours contemplating that. Envisioning Kate wet and sudsy and naked made him tent her floral-scented sheets. For several minutes after the shower went off, he heard her moving around. Then on the other side of the wall, things went still and silent. With spite, he hoped that for all the misery this sleeping arrangement was inflicting on him, she was suffering at least a little restlessness. Swearing, he reached up and clicked off the lamp. Catherine Lennon's house went dark. Down the street, Eben sat hunched in the driver's seat of Frida's car.
"Off to Betty Bye," he groused.
He stayed for another minute or so, then started the car and pulled away from the curb. As he drove past Bridger's monstrous pickup, he gave it the finger. He hadn't believed his eyes when Bridger showed up at her house. What the fuck? He'd actually shouted the words and struck the steering wheel with the heel of his hand when the tall, strapping, familiar form climbed out of the pickup and strode up to her door. Although he told himself now, as he navigated his way back home, if the prosecutor and Rebecca's ex were planning a sneak attack on him, he was better off knowing than not, right? Right. Looked at that way, it seemed that fortune was still favoring him. Earlier, he had made it out of Lennon's house and back to his car on foot just before seeing the patrol car turn onto her street. Note to self, she did have a silent alarm. He'd driven past her house while two cops were still prowling around it, shining their flashlights at doors and windows. He'd been smart enough to relock the lock he'd picked earlier. After the policeman left, he'd continued his surveillance. By then, it was approaching 10 o'clock, but he'd wanted to stick around for a while longer on the outside chance that he'd get a Catherine Lennon sighting. In the flesh. In the delectable flesh revealed by her scanty bikini. He'd called Frida and told her he'd gotten stuck with some old friends who were insisting on treating him to another round.
"No problem, sweetheart," she said. "I'll use Uber. In the morning, too. Have fun with your friends."
He'd wondered if his watchdog would follow the Uber car when it left with Frida, but he hadn't worried about it over much. If confronted, Frida would cover for him. Why couldn't everyone be as adoring and accommodating as Frida? Like Upton, for instance. That grumpy old fart. And his dad, who had spoiled him rotten, was now all of a sudden cracking down. He'd been about to give up on Catherine Lennon when a car had approached from the opposite direction and pulled into her driveway, then into her garage, the door of which had lowered immediately. He hadn't gotten a look at her. Lights had come on inside the house. Not long after, the has-been quarterback had made his appearance and ruined Eben's lurid fantasy of catching the prosecutor unawares, unprotected and unclothed except for a thong like the one in his pocket. Mouthing invectives aimed at Bridger, he turned onto his street, noting that his watchdog had either been called off or had followed the Uber car. In any case, he wasn't there. He opened the gate at the end of his drive with a remote and drove through. The landscape's artificial moonlight and strategically placed security spotlights were all that were on. His father's bedroom windows were dark. Good. He wouldn't be grilled in the artful manner that only his father was capable of on how he'd spent his evening. He drove around back and parked Frida's car in its place, but didn't immediately get out. He sat staring at nothing through the windshield, deep in thought. The gloating satisfaction he'd felt for having successfully violated Catherine Lennon's home, an underwear drawer, had been squelched by seeing Bridger. That bastard was turning up every fucking where. First, an unprecedented visit to Rebecca. Now, a sleepover at Catherine Lennon's house. the state prosecutor and the ex-husband, whose finger was on the button of Rebecca's fate, were cozied up and plotting the ruin of Eben Clark. It was funny when you thought about it. He actually laughed out loud.
Chapter 21. New Orleans was a city ravaged by corrosive elements, Mother Nature's foul temper, and political corruption. Yet it retained its unique charm, and a good part of its enchantment was due to decadence and decay. Under different circumstances, Kate would have been delighted to explore its eccentricities with Zach, but neither of them had any enthusiasm for this trip and had said little to each other after their good morning greeting when they'd met at the coffee maker in her kitchen. Each was subdued by dread. They'd spent most of the flight from Atlanta pretending to doze.
"This is it," Zach said.
He pulled the rental car to the curb in front of a brown brick house with cream-colored trim and a green composite roof. He'd told Kate that Mary and Doug Pratt had lived here for the entirety of their married life, and that Rebecca had been loath to claim the humble dwelling as where she'd spent her first 18 years. They got out of the car and walked toward the front door. Zach asked Kate if she knew what she was going to say.
"Generally," she replied, "but not specifically. Anything prepared would sound like a speech. I want him to see me as a person, not as a spokesperson."
"Let's hope. Here goes."
He pressed the doorbell. Doug answered the door dressed in khaki pants and a golf shirt, left untucked. Kate noted now, as she had at their initial meeting, that the only remarkable thing about him was that he'd fathered someone with Rebecca's exotic beauty and vitality. In every respect, Doug was average. Height, weight, mean. However, when he saw Zach, his bland features turned hostile. He scowled at Kate.
"When you called and asked to see me, you failed to mention that he was coming, too."
"I was afraid you wouldn't agree to see us."
"You are right about that."
Before he could shut the door, she said, "Mr. Pratt, Zach needs to be in on this discussion. You are intelligent and reasonable enough to understand why."
"I understand, all right. You two are ganging up on me in the hope of bringing me around to your way of thinking."
"You're mistaken," she said. "Zach continues to honor your wishes." He moved his gaze from her to Zach.
"Are you going to beat me up too?"
"Beat you up? What are you talking about?"
"That deputy sheriff, Dave Morris, called me this morning. Said you busted him up good."
"He threw the first punch after he almost caused me to skid off the cliff. I don't apologize for defending myself."
"He told me you weaseled my name out of him."
"If you wanted to know my frame of mind now that Clark is free, why didn't you ask me man to man? A phone call, an email. Instead, you hired a spy."
Pratt set his jaw and didn't respond. Zach made a sound of disgust.
"Grow up, Doug. This issue is a hell of a lot more critical than your pissing contest against me."
Before the interview could unravel further, Kate said,
"Mr. Pratt, Rebecca's fate still lies with you."
"Then what is there to talk about?"
"Eben Clark's fate, which also lies with you." She let that sink in, then said, "May we come in?" Looking sour, he unhooked the latch on the screen door and pushed it open.
"Hurry, or the cat will get out."
Inside, the atmosphere was stuffy. Dust motes danced in the streaks of sunlight allowed in through slits between partially closed Venetian blinds. Kate was glad when Doug led them through the house onto a screened-in back porch.
"It's not too humid out here today."
He sat down in a wicker rocking chair with a faded cushion. A tabby cat, who looked too old and infirm to escape through an open door, came over to the chair. Doug bent down and picked him up, laid him in his lap, and began stroking him. Kate sat in a matching chair that she figured had probably been the late Mary's customary seat. Zach had a settee all to himself. Once he was seated, he said,
"Doug, my condolences on Mary's passing. I didn't know until Kate told me."
"Didn't see any cause to tell you."
"I was her son-in-law."
"Not for long."
He scratched the cat between its rheumy eyes, then gestured over his shoulder.
I can't manage the housekeeping the way she did. Not and still go to the hospital every day.
Kate said, We stopped there before coming here. His eyes narrowed with suspicion, and he darted a resentful glance toward Zack before coming back to her.
What for?
Kate saw that as an opening. Based on what I'd been told and had read, I had a general knowledge of Rebecca's condition, but thought I needed to see her for myself in order to fully appreciate both Zack's dilemma and the heartache you've endured for the past 4 years. Your continual care for her is commendable, Mr. Pratt.
Do you have children?
No.
Then you wouldn't get it. Even being like she is now, Rebecca is still my little girl. Her spirit is in there somewhere. I won't give up on her.
He looked at Zack as though expecting him to throw down a gauntlet, but Zack remained silent and stoic. Kate said, You demonstrate your love and devotion to Rebecca daily.
I don't see it as a duty, if that's what you're driving at.
No, that wasn't what I was driving at, she said, with more patience than she was feeling. What I was driving at is that, in contrast to your self-sacrifice, the person who did this to her is now free to go about his life without any sense of obligation or responsibility. She reached into her bag for a folder and passed it to him. I'll leave this with you. You can read it or not.
What is it?
Do you remember Dr. Hawkins, who testified at the release hearing?
Yes. He shilly-shallied.
Who's Dr. Hawkins?
Zack asked. The psychologist who was assigned to Eben Clark while he was in prison.
What do you mean he shilly-shallied?
Zack asked, addressing the question to Doug.
On the witness stand, he rambled about Clark's delusions of grandeur, his sense of entitlement, lofty ego, so on.
Kate picked up. But when cross-examined, Dr. Hawkins was ground to dust by Clark's ruthless defense lawyer. He got the doctor to concede that most young men, especially those from prominent families, have inflated egos and feel entitled. But the most damaging part of the testimony was when the lawyer finagled the doctor into acknowledging that in some of his sessions with Clark, he had humbly expressed remorse for his recklessness that night and said that he would forever regret the tragic result. Words to that effect.
Was Hawkins lying?
No, she said. Clark had counted on Dr. Hawkins being subpoenaed to testify, so during their sessions leading up to the hearing, he convincingly play-acted being repentant.
My ass, Zack scoffed. He manipulated that doctor.
He tried, she said. Dr. Hawkins is a pro. He saw straight through Clark's pretending, but on the witness stand, when hammered to answer with either a yes or no, he was under oath to admit that Clark had, on more than one occasion, shown contrition.
So what's this?
Doug indicated the folder, which he'd set down on top of a thick, well-worn, leather-bound Bible on the table at his elbow. Kate said, Dr. Hawkins had a final session with Clark just before his release. His notes are in that folder. To summarize, Clark thanked him for his testimony at the hearing. He crowed over having beat the justice system. In reference to Rebecca, he was blasé, even callous, no remorse whatsoever. Kate heard Zack mutter an obscenity, but she kept her gaze fixed on Doug Pratt, whose hand now lay still on the cat.
Mr. Pratt, Eben Clark is a sociopath, an extremely clever and cruel trickster, an individual without a conscience. He has an insatiable appetite for every form of self-indulgence. He doesn't care whom he hurts in pursuit of anything he wants, whether it's a fast car, the blind obedience of his so-called friends, or sexual gratification.
Doug winced. Kate felt compassion for him, but she didn't back down. She was getting to the heart of the matter. This was why she had come. Do you remember the testimonies of the other two men involved?
At Clark's trial? Of course. How could I forget?
Then you'll recall their admissions that prior to the night with Rebecca, they'd had similar sex parties with scores of women. Every one of those occasions had been orchestrated by Eben Clark. She paused. I fear that other women will be victimized. Different circumstances, different outcomes than Rebecca's, please God. but whether or not Clark ever goes near another woman again. On that particular night, he stole your daughter's life from her. He stole her life from you and Mary. To the fullest extent of the law, he should be brought to justice for it. Sensing that she'd said enough, she eased back in her chair. Pratt stared through the screen at the cracked concrete birdbath in his backyard. The standing water in it was stagnant. Ponderous moments ticked by. Then he looked over at Zack.
"You're ready to do it, aren't you?"
Zack closed his eyes briefly, then opened them and said,
"I'll never be ready to do it, Doug. But it's as plain as day that you're leaning that way."
Zack took another moment before speaking.
"Putting aside your religious convictions and my moral and ethical ambiguities, and even disregarding the privileged sociopath who's responsible, I've started focusing on Rebecca. I think about the indignity that she is subjected to 24/7, 365. If we were able to ask her, don't you think she would beg us to end it without delay?"
Pratt inhaled several times through his nostrils.
"You know what I think? I think you want payback for her committing adultery. Doug, you're tired of paying the bills for her keep at that special hospital. I didn't ask you to, you know. You volunteered, and now you're regretting a bad investment." "Don't you see what you're doing?" Zack said. "You're angry with me, but you're taking it out on Rebecca. You were just itching to kill her 4 years ago, weren't you?"
Zack ran his fingers through his hair.
"Christ."
He looked at Kate with asperity and futility. Seeing that he was getting to him, Doug picked up steam.
"What stopped you from doing it then?" "My personal conflict. Your feelings. Mary's." "Ah, you didn't give a crap about our feelings. It was the bad publicity you'd get for snuffing your ex. Come on now. Admit it here in front of Ms. Lennon. The only reason you spared Rebecca's life then was because you didn't want to look bad to your adoring fans."
"Not true," Zack said softly.
"What's changed your mind, huh? What's different this time around? I don't think you give a flip about Eben Clark getting justly punished. I think it's because you're a wash-up and have less to lose now."
By the time he'd finished, Zack was already on his feet. He said to Kate,
"I'll be outside."
His footsteps thumped over creaking floor planks as he made his way through the house. They heard the front screen door slap shut. Kate's cheeks were hot with indignation. She picked up her bag and stood. "That was uncalled for, Mr. Pratt, and beneath you. You have my contact information." She started for the door, but then turned back.
"Why didn't you see to it that Zack resigned as her agent 4 years ago?"
"Wasn't necessary. He cut and ran. Big number 12 turned Rebecca over to Mary and me because he didn't want a media smear if he told the doctors to let her die."
"That's not at all fair, Mr. Pratt. You know that."
"I was there. You weren't."
He bobbed his head as though he'd had his say, and that was all there was to it. But she wasn't ready to let him get away with denouncing Zack.
"What about since then? Why haven't you insisted on making your guardianship legal?"
"Haven't needed to. He's left us alone."
"I don't think that's the reason at all. I think you relish keeping him tethered and miserable."
He batted the air with his hand.
"Think what you want, but the fact is that as long as he's stayed up there on his mountain, fine. But now he's back. He's meddling. I'm going to talk to my lawyer and see what I have to do. In the meantime, Bridger better not try and get the jump on me."
"You mean regarding Rebecca? He wouldn't do that."
"He sneaked down here to see her, didn't he? He had a private meeting with Dr. Gilbreth. He tagged along with you."
Her patience wearing thin, she said, "No, I tagged along with him. He hoped to discuss with you, calmly and reasonably, even Clark's release and how it might change your perspective."
"I think you've changed his perspective, is what I think."
"I've explained the legal ramifications to him just as I did to you."
"You've twisted his thinking, though. He's waffling. I can tell. He could go behind my back and take my girl off the feeding tube before I knew about it."
She could tell that arguing was futile. She pulled her bag onto her shoulder. Zach told you 4 years ago that he wouldn't take any action without your knowledge and consent. He's kept that promise. Much to his detriment, Mr. Pratt, and to yours, but mostly to Rebecca's. Kate left him there sitting in his rocker with his mangy cat and made her way quickly through the house. Zach was sitting in the car, his elbows propped on the lowest arc of the steering wheel, his hands clasped above it. The double fist was pressed against his chin and mouth. He was staring through the windshield and seemed not to notice her until she opened the passenger door and got in. "I should pity him," she said. "He's pathetic. But I can't feel anything except contempt for an individual who claims to be so grounded in religion, but holds you, anybody, in such rank contempt."
"Don't waste your energy being angry with him. I've learned the hard way that it only wears you to a nub, not him."
"No, I'm going to continue being angry, for a while at least. It made me furious the way he kept goading you about why you didn't take Rebecca off life support before, when all along, it was to spare him and Mary. Questioning your motive is so unfair."
"Not really, Kate. My motive wasn't just to spare their feelings, and it wasn't to avoid bad publicity.
Still,